This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Worth a try, and he's always prepared to give it a go.
On the Ball on BFM 89.9.
Hello, this is On the Ball, the first On the Ball since, well, tragedy struck. But more on that in a moment. Let me introduce, alongside myself, Cam Ruslan, our three pundits. We have Bob Holmes.
Hello, everybody. It's good to be back, if a little somber on this occasion. Unbelievably, we have another death to record, but we shall do that and get on with the football business as usual.
Absolutely. And we also have Kishanan Sundaresan.
Hello, hello, guys. Definitely great to be back as well. I mean, the circumstances aren't great, but it is what it is. And for Ross's memory, at least, it's definitely good to be back.
Absolutely. And finally, we have Des Corkill.
And yes, it is, of course, somber. But in the true tradition of both Ross and Shebby, who we'll talk about, it's not going to stop me complaining about VAR.
Well, absolutely, Des. Neither Ross nor Shebby would be able to stop you. Well, as the guys mentioned just now, a few weeks ago we lost Ross Youssouf, which is why I'm now presenting the show. And then tragedy struck again in the world of Malaysian football broadcasting, when the great Shebby Singh passed away very suddenly. Just 2 days ago. And he was actually on the first ever football show here with Ross on BFM. And each of us are going to say something, but I want to start with you, Des, because you probably knew him and worked with him the most.
Yeah, I've been working with him since the old ESPN Star Sports days, where he's one of the guests on the John Dyke show alongside Paul Masefield, Jamie Reeves. And the comments... Dykesy posted a Twitter tribute to Shebby. The comments of the number of people he impacted as they had an Asian face that they could really get into, who was taken seriously. They disagreed with him passionately, but he broke, to take a phrase from one of Keishan's tweets, he broke so many glass ceilings as a player. In that move from Johor up to Kuala Lumpur, where he had that ban as a player, and then of course he took on the My Team Challenge. Then he became a pundit. Then he went to Blackburn and took an awful lot of cop for that. But I interviewed him in depth for Astro on one occasion. He was adamant he did a great thing, and he said, I spotted the Portuguese before anybody else, and he's dead right. And in his latter years, he was still a good commentator for MFL and an avid cyclist. And the rich irony is that he was such a fit man. He was a young 61, didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't have any bad vices, looked after himself, and not one of the guys you'd expect to go. It's very sad, but I intend to celebrate a life really, really well lived.
Absolutely. And Bob, well, I mean, you know, Shebby Singh, he was part of the landscape, wasn't he?
Absolutely. I only met him once, actually, to interview him when I was doing a book about foreign owners. And you'll know where I'm going with this. Blackburn Rovers, who had still have, amazingly, the Venkis, who are among the, shall we say, more idiosyncratic owners of football clubs. And Shevy, famously, was appointed as their global advisor. No one will ever forget that role. No one's ever had it since. I don't think the Russians or the Americans or the Chinese have even had a statesman in that role. But Shevy Singh was Blackburn Rovers' global advisor. And I was went in there quite hard, because I was being critical of the Venkis, and I was wondering what I was going to get, how Chevy was going to react and all that. And I'd read that he always calls a spade, and he's got a thick skin and all that. So I thought I'd test him out. And I got him on this global advisor thing. And his defense of that was that he was operating in two continents. He was also ostensibly spotting talent for Blackburn in Asia, as well as working primarily in Blackburn. So he spanned two continents. And therefore, he said, I couldn't be the Asian advisor. I couldn't be the European advisor. So Madame Venke came up with global advisor. And he took an awful lot of stick for that, but he had the skin thick enough to stand it. And I was very impressed with the way he handled it. And again, a very great loss way too early in the season. Very sad indeed.
Yeah. Now, Keish, you're a Malaysian. You're a young Malaysian. You're a football pundit. Surely Shebby must be an icon for you.
Yeah, 100%, Cam. I think if you ask anyone who grew up in my generation as well, it goes without saying that Shebby Singh's influence is absolutely massive. He's been able to, not just like Des pointed out, break glass ceilings, but he's been able to... there's this thing called representation, right? We talk about it when we talk about films, for example, when we see, Black Panther, how important was it for the Black community to see a Black individual being casted as a superhero? When we talk about Wonder Woman, for females out there, how important it is to see a female being cast as a superhero as well, and why representation essentially matters. And Shebby Singh is the same. It was fundamentally important for people like me and so many other to see someone who comes from a similar background, who comes from a similar set of challenges, comes from a similar identity, to be the face of football in this region. And I think that opened the doors for people like me, for people like so many others that I know of as well, to not just be more attached to the game, but to also be able to dream about wanting to work in the game. And without someone like Shebby, I think that dream becomes that just that much more or that much less possible, right? And the fact that he enabled stuff like that for so many of us around, I think his impact, you just cannot quantify it, and you cannot even describe it in words. It's absolutely incredible. And like Des pointed out, it was a life truly well lived, and I choose to celebrate him for that as well.
Yeah, and also he was a really lovely man. Just such a nice man. So we move on because football moves on, and we will move on. We've got a packed show. We're going to try and get through League Cup, FA Cup fourth round draw, Premier League, Spanish Super Cup, and some African Cup of Nations. So we're going to begin, though, with the semi-final played just now between Liverpool and Arsenal. I'm going to start with you, Des, as a Liverpudlian. The Liverpool Echo, your newspaper, called it feeble, the display by Liverpool. But to be fair, they've been hit by COVID, and also they're only missing two of the best players in the world, Sadio Mane and Mohamed Salah. So, give them some slack, surely.
In the modern environment, you're not allowed to give a little bit of slack. In the old days, not conceding at home is not the worst result that you can get. Missed opportunities. Minamino had a golden opportunity very, very late on. But of course, you'll miss Salah and Mane. But let's not forget, even with Salah and Mane, we struggled to break down Chelsea when they went down to 10 minutes Anfield. So, it could be worse. Arsenal deserve credit. Arsenal are a completely different team now. The Arteta process seems to be working. Well, the one thing that's beginning just to seep through for Liverpool, though, is that if Jurgen Klopp doesn't win more trophies, despite his phenomenal success, despite the billions against from Manchester City, etc., and the different status, but does he then become one of the great greats? He already is a great. But if Liverpool don't win trophies, does that reputation get tarnished just a little bit. And so I think the League Cup is important for Liverpool, for the, at least to make the final. So the second leg next week down at the Emirates is a really important game. Missed opportunities here, but they kept a clean sheet. And so they go in absolutely all square. And I'd like Liverpool to hit on the break. I think Liverpool hit better on the break without Mane. They can hit better on the break with the team. We also missed Thiago Alcantara. I wish he was there.
And Keish, let's jump to the other semi-final that has now already happened, where the Chelsea B team absolutely thrashed the Spurs B team. But what did we learn there? But also, I'm wondering, do you think that Conte actually engineered this disaster? Do you think he actually maybe wanted it to happen in order to sort of show Daniel Levy, this is what I have to work with?
I mean, with Conte, you cannot rule anything out completely. He's this stubborn guy who knows exactly what he wants and knows exactly what he needs to accomplish what he wants. I don't think at this point, I would be surprised if Conte hasn't already told Daniel Levy that he needs more signings. Because I think in the short period of time that he's been there, it's pretty evident that you can see bits and pieces of the Conte philosophy. But obviously, Spurs do not necessarily have the squad to completely deal with his demands. It's something that had to happen at Inter Milan as well, that process of rebuilding the squad. But specifically in the context of this game, this was an important one for both teams. I think for Spurs, it's about that trophy, right? It's about that trophy that has haunted them for a very long time now. But for Chelsea, it's also about trying to get a bit of form back. Because over the last 2 months, they've just had a lot of ups and downs in terms of their performances in the league. And that entire Romelu Lukaku saga didn't help as well. But this game, I thought Chelsea were completely dominant. They created the better chances. And the guy who scored the goal, I mean, Rudiger, there's a lot of rumours about his future at the club as well. But he continues to prove as to why he deserves that contract extension, as to why he deserves the big money that he's demanding. He's been absolutely phenomenal for Chelsea this season.
Well, so, Bob, that's the small story of the League Cup. But let's jump to the big story
here.
Can
I just interject? Go ahead. I can't leave that Chelsea game without talking about VAR. Cannot. Because Martin Atkinson, a very reputable, respected referee, got two bad decisions wrong. He gave penalties and VAR overruled them. And the assistant referee missed a clear offside for a Harry Kane disallowed goal and VAR corrected. So VAR, the VAR protagonist will say, fabulous, VAR got three things right. I am completely in the reverse and think that Martin Atkinson, he's lost any respect, or not respect, any authority that he once had, because he's not made one mistake, not made two mistakes, he's made three big mistakes in a major semi-final and has been shown up on all three occasions. I said from the start, VAR in itself isn't awful. What it does is it demeans the referee's authority. In the old days when Bob and I and even Keish were playing football, referees will never change their mind. Now they do routinely. It is to the detriment of the game, even if it's right. Being right, as I know, isn't always the only thing.
So, Des, we're going to do some really good, really classic VAR and referee decisions later when we talk about Africa Cup of Nations. So we'll bring you back in for that one. In a moment, we're going to be going to the Premier League here on the ball, VFM 89.9.
Deserved a goal, that. Lovely return pass, just wide.
On the ball on VFM 89.9.
And we're back with On The Ball with, well, you know who they are, Des Corkhill, Bob Holmes and Keish. And now we're going to go on to the Premier League, some of the midweek matches that were played. Southampton 4, Brentford 1. Now, at the beginning of the season, when I saw Brentford, I thought, they're going to win the league. And I also thought, Southampton, they're in the league. How times have changed. A season of two halves. Des, do you fear the Marty's Southampton now?
I think Southampton have... when they lost Danny Ings, I thought that they'd lose an awful lot of their potency. But they seem to have replaced him. scoring four goals against Brentford, who aren't the easiest to get past. And they're now unbeaten in five games. So I think Southampton are going to be one of these yo-yo teams where you'll have four wins where they do well, and then they'll sweep through, and then five and they'll lose. But they've certainly got enough defensively to look after themselves in midfield. Well, as long as James Ward-Prowse is there, they've got a very competitive midfield. And they're scoring goals as well now. So, I'm not worried for Southampton. I'm more worried for Brentford, because I think their early season enthusiasm is still there, but the results aren't there, and they've lost three of the last four. They've conceded four against Southampton. So I'd be more worried for Brentford to get sucked in to a relegation battle than Southampton, who I think have got enough know-how and a very good coach to stay up.
Yeah, and also Brentford do have a cushion of several points. A real pro like Ross Youssef would know exactly how many. So, I want to, Keish, I'm going to jump on to the glamour match, which was, of course, West Ham 2, Norwich 0. I want to go to you because I really want to know something. West Ham, what is their style? How they're doing so well. How do they do it? What are they doing?
They're doing what David Moyes has been able to do with so many teams over the years. It's pragmatic football at its absolute finest. The thing about David Moyes is he got so much of slander for his Man United stint, and then, you know, a couple of disappointing stints that followed afterwards, almost as if people forgot everything he did with Everton, everything he did, he accomplished with an Everton side that barely had any money to spend. I mean, back in like around 2006, when I was still a kid, I would go on laptops and play Football Manager. And Everton were one of the worst teams for you to pick to play on those games because their budget was literally zero. And that's the kind of reality that David Moyes had to work with. And it's something similar that he's doing with West Ham at the moment. Because if you look at West Ham's trajectory over the last few years, you'd realize that they've chopped and changed managers. They've made big name signings like Felipe Anderson. They've splashed the cash every now and then. But the reality is they've come back to a pretty sane environment under David Moyes. They're making smart acquisitions at the moment. And the team looks extremely balanced. I would say at this point in time, West Ham's midfield partnership of Declan Rice and Thomas Suchek is significantly better than even Man United's midfield, who have spent so much of money over the years. And that's how, you know, balanced this West Ham side is. And the coaching from David Moyes has certainly helped them as well. Make no mistakes, this isn't just about the quality of players that they have, but this is absolutely 110% David Moyes as well. West Ham, this season, if this run continues, I wouldn't put it past them to be in the Europa League or even make a late push for the Champions League.
Yeah, Declan Rice is a player that this season I've really grown to think is absolutely brilliant. I used to hear the hype, but now he's like, oh yeah, I understand it now. Let's jump forward now and start looking ahead. And I want to ask you three a question. See, I've always been a pundit on the Monday show, Off the Ball, where we look back at matches, and so we don't have to make any predictions. You guys, on the other hand, always look forward. And I wonder, have you ever done an audit on your predictions? I wonder. So we're going to put Bob to the test first, and I'm going to start taking note, and there'll be an exam result at the end of the season.
Is there any prize money?
Oh, he thinks he's going to win. No. I'm wondering who's going to come last. Let's start then with, well, it's going to be the biggest match. At the beginning of this season, when I watched Chelsea, I thought, they're going to win the league. And they've gone off the ball slightly. Man City have been building up. Bob, this is going to be quite a match, is it not?
Well, it could be, yes. I mean, it's that old phrase, must win again, isn't it, for Chelsea? And I think for interest in the title race and for Liverpool. I mean, Liverpool will be hoping Chelsea win this or a draw. That's very unusual for Liverpool fans to wish Chelsea any sort of success. But on this occasion, something has got to stop City from running away with this. And even the loss of Riyad Mahrez to Algeria in the AFCON has barely been noticed. They've got so many players. You forget who's out. you can have two or three players down with COVID injuries, and it doesn't seem to make one iota of difference to the way they play. They just move the pieces around and just swat away opposition pretty easily. So having said that, I think Chelsea have picked up. I think they've stopped the rot. And I think they will provide a fairly formidable opposition on this occasion, because they know their season basically rests on this. I mean, they're still in everything else. They're in the final of the League Cup. They're still in the FA Cup, and they're still in the Champions League. And they're the holders, of course. Let's not forget that. So there's everything to play for. But this is the one they really want. They want to be able to run Man City down. And now they've got Lukaku and Werner back. It'll be interesting to see whether Tuchel plays them both. I doubt it, as it's an away game at City. I mean, if they go behind, you may see the two of them together. And an interesting pairing, I think. I'm not convinced that they can't play together. They have different strengths, but they both have pace. And I think that is the interesting thing. You rarely get a strike partnership where both strikers have a lot of pace, but these two do. So they are potentially a lethal duo, and they could test the Man City defense. But I'm afraid we may not see them until they go a goal behind. So, yeah, this will be a very watchable game until City go ahead. Then you're going to see, I think, the usual result, a Man City home win. They're very formidable at the Etihad, and I think the odds are on City. But Chelsea will go down fighting, I'm sure of that.
Okay, I'm going to make a note of that, Bob, all right? You're down as a City win, and you will be held accountable.
Okay.
So I want to move on, though, to one of the fiercest rivalries, actually, in the Premier League. One of the strangest, too. Brighton versus Crystal Palace. A season of two halves. At the beginning of the season, when I watched Crystal Palace, I thought they're going to win the league. And Brighton, meanwhile, couldn't score. But now it seems to have turned around, and Brighton are getting it together. What's going on down south? Des?
Well, Brighton actually started the season really, really well. And we noticed, remember when they got rid of, was it Chris Hughton? They were boring Brighton, and the new coach came in, and we liked what they did last year. We liked the fact that they tried to play games. And this year they've been able to add a little bit of defensive solidity. They conceded only 20 goals this season. So a goal a game is reasonable. They're in the top half of the table, but they're also scoring a reasonable a share of goals as well. And they're going to places like Liverpool. I remember the performance at Liverpool where they were terrific. And they deservedly got a point at Anfield. They deservedly went to Everton last time out and won 3-2. And they're a good little team. Like you, with Palace, at the start of the season, I thought Palace were doomed, and then I saw them play. And I think Palace are the unluckiest team so far this year. I think they're 12 to 14 points shy of where they deserve to be, what they've earned, and I'm sure that'll turn around in the second half of the season. But they need to get results in these big games. So as you say, local rivalry, Brighton playing well with confidence. Lallana's made a heck of a difference, by the way. Got to say, he just controls the midfield there. Palace play a higher line, but they've had defensive injuries, and that's caused a little bit of the upset in the balance. But I'm anticipating the fortunes of both teams just to switch over the next part of the season. And this is where it'll be start. So I'm calling a Crystal Palace win for your notebook, Cam.
Okay.
And Brighton just to start dropping off just a little bit.
Can I just point out that in many ways it feels like Palace this season are like the Brighton of last season.
Yeah.
Because Brighton last season were incredibly, you know, unlucky. Because they were consistently doing well in games. They were creating opportunities. But they just couldn't convert them. They were, in fact, the Premier League team with the lowest conversion rate when it comes to big chances, right? And this season, you watch Palace and it's sometimes the same thing as well. So it's you will cross that bridge when you at some point, and you look at Palace's quality, you look at the young players that they have, you look at the exciting football they can play. I wish it'll come sooner.
So everybody, predicted Crystal Palace to go down this season, but that's just not going to happen, is it? All of you, Crystal Palace are going to remain, aren't they?
Yeah, yes. I think so, definitely.
Yeah, and Patrick Vieira is he's good.
Well, he's starting to make a name. I think we've said before that he hadn't had a raging success in his managerial career. This is probably the best he's done. He's been around a bit. He was at Nice and New York City and didn't sort of uproot any trees at either place. But he's done a very good job here. He's bought well. He's blended young players with experienced players. He's got rid of a whole raft of aging Roy Hodgson acquisitions who were on big money. Saved a lot of money on the wage bill and steered them to mid-table or lower mid-table. But as I agree with Des there, they deserve to be upper mid-table, I think, on the performances so far. So I think he's done a very good job.
Yeah. Well, that's Crystal Palace, which for some reason some people think is my team. It is not. So we move on, though. In a moment, we're going to come back with some of the really big matches that are going to be happening this weekend here on the Ball on BFM 89.9.
What about that clearance off the line? How important did that turn out to be in the end?
On the Ball on BFM 89.9.
And we're back with On the Ball here on BFM. And we're going to be looking forward to some of the big Premier League matches that are coming up. And Keish, I want to start with, I don't know, once upon a time, back in the 1890s, this would have been the biggest match of all. Aston Villa versus Manchester United. And I'm wondering, actually, you know, Aston Villa, the glory days, a long time past. Is it going to be the same story for Manchester United? Can they get their act together?
That is a heavy question, Cam. And that is not a question that I will attempt to answer, because that will take an entire episode. Can Man United get back to their past? But the bottom line is that this game is an extremely exciting one. It's always been. Whenever Man United play Villa over the years, it's always been an exciting fixture. And I think even more so now due to some of the different characters that we have in the team, right? Obviously, Steven Gerrard being the manager of Aston Villa adds a bit of bite to it. Now that you've got Philippe Coutinho coming back to the team as well, back to the Premier League as well, he's got the Liverpool element in him, so that'll be a big game. But for Man United at the moment, there's a lot of trouble to look past. You look at this fixture and you'll think, I don't think they even have time to consider the Gerrard and Coutinho elements, because within their own camp, there appears to be a lot of fractions. If you just watched the Cristiano Ronaldo interview with Sky Sports a couple of days ago, some of the comments that he was making, some of the lines that he used, you know, insinuating that some of the younger players within the clubs don't want to listen to him or don't really want to listen to the seniors. Things like this are being said out loud in public. And that is an indication of the fractions that exist within the dressing room. And I think those problems are the bigger headaches for Man United at the moment. And it's something that Ralf Rangnick would have to genuinely address. The thing about Ralf is, we all know that he's an innovator. We all know that he's a master tactician. And when it comes to tactics, when it comes to ideas, when it comes to philosophy, I'm a big fan of him too. But I think the big challenge for him at Man United right now is quite possibly something that he has never faced in his career, which is managing big egos from a individual standpoint, from a human standpoint. And I think it remains to be seen if he's up to that task. But when it comes to tactics, yes, but right now, the problems at Man United run much deeper than just tactics.
Give me a scoreline, Keish, that you can be judged by.
Oh, wow. I'm actually going to go for a Villa win here. I've been very impressed with Villa under Steven Gerrard. I think Gerrard has come to the Premier League at the perfect time. They're playing some progressive football. Some of their key signings are slowly getting activated by Gerrard. And I think Luka Dean coming in is a massive signing as well. He's been tremendous. So I think Villa could genuinely beat Man United here.
Can I just add two?
I would go with the scoreline of 2-1.
Sorry to interrupt there, Keish, but I'd just like to add my 2 cents worth here. I read where some of the United players had never heard of Ralf Rangnick and had to Google him to find out what he was all about. Now, scarcely believable, isn't it? Thomas Tuchel and Jurgen Klopp and many others regard him as the guru of gegenpressing, and he's highly respected in coaching circles. But if that's true, that they'd never heard of him, it's going to be very difficult for him to command the usual respect and the new manager bounce. Well, he hasn't had it, has he? He's only lost one game, actually. But they say he lacks charisma, he lacks presence, and all this sort of thing. And he's 63 years old, and he's a couple of generations away from some of those players. And it's not working. It's a little bit early to doom it to death, but it's not yet working. And it doesn't reflect well on the United players, does it, so far? I have to say that.
I think if we did an inventory of what young football players do know and do not know, it could be quite shocking, actually, what they would find necessary to Google.
Can I interject one more time, please? Aston Villa, Manchester United, VAR in the FA Cup. They discovered a way to disallow a goal that is absolutely brand new. There wasn't a foul near the ball. There wasn't a foul on the goalkeeper. There wasn't a foul by the goal scorer. He wasn't offside. They looked for 55,000 different ways to disallow a goal, and they found one. Good old VAR interjecting where it is not needed.
Yeah, I gotta admit that was a head scratcher, that one. Also, Andy Carroll's goals for Reading.
Absolutely.
Great goals, and I couldn't work out what the problem was. Was he offside? I don't know. I'm going to jump to, back to Des, actually, hogging the limelight, because we have to talk about, we've talked about already, but let's put them together now, Liverpool versus Brentford. Who is going to be in the lineup for Liverpool?
So it's who's not in the lineup, which is the problem. We know about Salah and Mane. That was planned for, and I think Jurgen Klopp was okay that Divock Origi and Minamino would get an extended run to actually prove that he's got faith in them. Origi's injured, or Origi missed the game at Arsenal. Hopefully he's back. But for me, the biggest problem for Liverpool is Thiago Alcantara's absence. He was the difference. He was meant to be able to just introduce something new to Liverpool. He's never had a run of games. He's got a thigh injury now, or a hip or a thigh injury. And that means we have quite a pedestrian midfield that, as you saw it in against the 10 men of Arsenal, find it difficult to break teams down without the individuality of Mane and Salah, which we knew about. Bobby Firmino will create one or two things. Jota will work hard. Minamino will get into positions, but the creativity will be missing. Fabinho's a wonderful number six. Milner and Henderson, fabulous in what they do. But who's going to create that Coutinho role, which Thiago Alcantara was meant to be doing? So I worry that Liverpool will struggle to score goals against Brentford and then Palace in the Mane-Sale absence. And that could absolutely catapult them way, way, way out of the Championship, where they're clinging on by their fingernails, and actually bring them back to the pack of chasing fourth. So that's a worry over the next couple of games. You throw in the League Cup semi-final, and I think this is really important. And the one man I wish was there above everybody was Thiago. I see Liverpool beating Brentford, but certainly not easily.
4-0 then. I'm going to put that one down for you, Des. Yeah? So I'm going to jump to Keisha. You're maybe too young to remember when Tottenham Hotspur and Arsenal was a big clash of big clubs. But they're still quite famous in the North London area. I don't know which side's going to lose better than the other side for me.
I mean, the impressive Hotspur thing about
never asked that question.
Spurs are a side that are slowly building. Arsenal are a side that are slowly building as well. But Arsenal are far ahead of Spurs at the moment in terms of where they are in the rebuilding process. And it, it, it's great. It's genuinely great to see Arteta finally getting some form of respect after almost a year of people just consistently slandering him, saying that he's not good enough. But we're finally starting to see a bit of identity with this Arsenal side, with the injection of young players like Emil Smith Rowe, like Bukayo Saka. And you look at the signings that have come in as well. These signings have all been very tailor-made to what Arteta wants to see in the team. The signings have not necessarily been big name, big characters, but they've all come in with something to, a hole to plug, a gap to fill. Players like, you know, Tomiyasu at right back, who's been terrific for Arsenal. Aaron Ramsdale, heavily criticised when he first signed, but he's obviously silenced his critics since then. And then you've got Ben White as well, who I thought was, by the way, really good last night, Ben White. He was really, really good at the heart of the defence. So I think there's a lot to be excited about when it comes to this Arsenal side. And regardless of whether this is played at the Emirates or the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, I would genuinely put Arteta's Arsenal as slight favourites for this fixture.
And speaking of big clubs, the richest club in the world is now Riyadh on the Tyne, Newcastle, who are obviously flying at the top of the league because they're that good and they have that much money. No, seriously, Bob, Newcastle United, richest club in the world, are they going to get? Are they in a relegation dogfight here with Watford? Is this a six-pointer?
Yes, it is. I think it's the second biggest game on the calendar this weekend. All eyes will be on it, not least because Newcastle have made two, I think, quite sensible signings. The one is Kieran Trippier, who they got fairly cheaply from Atletico Madrid. Needs no introduction, England international. Chris Wood from Burnley. They overpaid for him because he's 30 years old and he had a release clause of 25 million. He's only scored 3 goals this season, but he has scored more than 10 goals in the last 4 seasons, each of the last 4 seasons. So he's a reliable sort of second-rate striker. He's not top-notch, but he's a big guy, he's good in the air, and Newcastle need a presence up front with Callum Wilson being out long-term. That's a big loss to them. This is a short-term strategy, but when you've got that sort of money that the Newcastle owners have, why not get somebody in who can do a job for you if it's going to avoid relegation? And it seems as if that is their priority, as it should be, at all costs, to stay up. And that may just swing it. They're negotiating for a few other players, they say. They've made good progress. They haven't named any names. I don't expect Kylian Mbappe or anybody like that. But so far, so good. Trippier and Chris Wood, I think these are reasonably sensible signings given the circumstances. So that probably tilts the balance towards Newcastle in this game. Watford have been badly hit by AFCON. They were in danger of losing 5 players, but they've managed to hang on to Emmanuel Dennis, much to Nigeria's anger. They said that Watford tried everything humanly possible to avoid him leaving for AFCON. And, well, they've succeeded. I don't know how, but they've managed to hang on to him. And he's been their best player this season. He's had 13 goal involvements in 16 games. He's been playing brilliantly. So that could swing things. We see there's so much resting on staying in the Premier League. It's so much money at stake that clubs will do anything to bend the rules, to hang on to their players. I mean, Liverpool tried to hang on to their players, didn't they? I mean, they didn't do anything illegal, but everyone knows they were extremely reluctant to let them go because it could be that they lose these guys for up to a month. And even then, they probably need a week or so to adjust when they come back. So you can't really blame the player, the clubs for hanging on to them. But I if you want a prediction from me, I would go for Newcastle to win this.
Wow. Okay, well, they need it. So there are several other matches being played in the Premier League. I'm looking through them. There's Burnley, Everton, Southampton, blah, blah, blah. So because in a moment, though, we're going to go for the big stuff, which is we're going to do the big stuff here. We're going to go around the world, Spanish Super League, Super Cup and Africa Cup of Nations when we come back here on the Ball on BFM 89.9.
It is a fine goal.
Fine header, fine goal.
On the Ball on BFM 89.9.
And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Bob Holmes, Des Corkill, and Keishanan. And now we come to, we're going to go around the world here because that's how we work here at BFM. And I don't know about the match itself, but the setup of this match, the Spanish Super Cup, where Barcelona 2, Real Madrid 3, but it was the location, I think, really, that caught my eye as a person who doesn't follow Spanish football too closely. It was held in Riyadh, in Saudi Arabia. And Des Corkill, go! Off the leash.
Yeah, I'm sure the Madrid and Barcelona fans will have gone there in their thousands to support their team. It's a sellout. It's purely about money. I mean, the Super Cups in Europe are taken a little bit more seriously than they are in England. But to have it in the middle of the season, Barcelona, Real Madrid, it wasn't even a sellout, you know. Riyadh was only half full, which tells you that somebody has given them a nice big wedge of money, which is great, particularly for Barcelona at the moment. But it's pure business. I remember when Santos in the 60s did a world tour purely because of the money and all their games. Everyone was thrilled to see Pelé when he played. But none of the games mattered. And there's a problem if the game doesn't matter. And so I tried to do an analysis of this, saying, hey, can Barcelona take some credit for this? Even in defeat, they pushed Real Madrid all the way. And then I realised it doesn't really matter, you know. It really does not matter. They've been given a wedge of money to go and play somewhere miles away. It's not done Saudi football any good whatsoever. Doesn't help the interests of Saudi football. I know more of this is going to happen, but like VAR, I will rail against it and I will happily be a lone man railing against it.
I don't think you would be alone. I'm sure Bob will join you in that. But you know, Bob, Barcelona need the money. I mean, they like really, really need the money.
Well, do they? Yes,
great question.
We've read that they're bankrupt, but they've made a deal with Goldman Sachs. I think everyone in Malaysia has heard of them. a billion euro loan from Goldman Sachs to keep them going. Now, how much interest do you think Goldman Sachs are charging them for that? I don't know, but it's got to be around 10%. But Barca are desperate. You know, they've just paid 55 million for Ferran Torres from Man City. I mean, he's a good signing. I'm surprised that City let him go. But what are we to make of this? I mean, one minute they're bankrupt. The next minute they're buying players from Man City for £55 million. Well, okay, they've got the loan. But I tell you what, if COVID does its worst, they're going to be in big trouble because they're dependent on having nearly 100,000 people watching every game. They are... I mean, not many clubs are really dependent on gate money anymore. It's all broadcasting. But Barcelona, because they've got such a big ground and the setup of the club, and they're one of the Nou Camp and its museum are one of Spain's biggest tourist attractions. They get a tremendous amount of money through the gate. And that's why one of the reasons they've been in such a mess, they've missed out on all that money. And they're banking on recovering with younger players, judicious signings, and big crowds to come back. And that's why they've taken the risk of this loan. So good luck to them. I mean, I don't want to see them. I don't want to see them fail. Barcelona, a global institution, but it's a massive risk. And it just shows the skewed finances of modern football, doesn't it?
Yeah. Keish, I'm not really sure what a Super Cup is, but you follow European football more closely than I do. There was also the Italian Super Cup. One, perhaps you could explain to me what a Super Cup is. But also, in the case of the Italian Super Cup, you had the result being Inter 2, Juventus 1. Juventus, once upon a time, absolute, well, not so very long ago, dominant in Italy, but struggling so much now. What is happening there?
If you were to, because Juventus released a documentary on Amazon Prime, it's called All or Nothing Juventus, which documented their journey throughout last year. And if you watch that documentary, I think it becomes pretty evident just how problematic this club has evolved over the last couple of seasons. Actually, even longer than that, over the last 5 years. Yes, they've stayed at the top. Yes, they've remained competitive. But the problems at the club run very deep. From boardroom level to divisions within the players to the financial systems. I mean, not too long ago, the Juventus offices in Italy were raided by the cops. I think it was about 2 months ago when the owner, Andrea Agnelli, Pavel Nedved, all of them just flew over to London to seek protection while the clubs were being raided. So it's things are problematic there at the moment. They thought that, you know, the moment they sacked Andrea Pirlo, that bringing an old coach in the form of Allegri back would, you know, stabilize the squad again, would inject a bit of positive vibes around the club. But the reality is Juventus have been struggling as well. And they're struggling to find their feet. They're struggling to get results. The balance within the club has been a bit messy. So there's a lot going on at Juventus at the moment. It's a bit reminiscent of Barcelona, to be fair, if I'm being absolutely honest here. But when it comes to Inter Milan, I think Inter are the ones that Juventus will be looking at and feeling a bit jealous at the moment. Because Inter Milan lost Antonio Conte over the summer. Inter Milan lost Ashraf Hakimi over the summer. They also lost Romelu Lukaku. Now, when you lose players of this caliber, you'd expect the reigning champions to drop their form, to go down the drain, to go on a downward spiral. But ultimately, what they've done is just they've survived with Simone Inzaghi being appointed as the head coach. They've replaced Lukaku with a veteran guy in the form of Edin Dzeko, who is still scoring goals for fun in the Serie A. And they look incredibly stable on the pitch. And there's a sense of a good friend of mine wrote this article about how Inter Milan, when you watch them play, it's like watching an orchestra at the moment. Everything feels synchronized. Everything feels stable despite the turmoil that they've been through over the summer. So it's not surprising to see Inter Milan win this game. And they were easily the better side as well.
I wish I could speak so eloquently about the Italian game.
Very good.
that was fantastic. Anyway, yeah, so we're going to move on, though, to a huge story, really, which is not really being given, I think, its due. Ian Wright, in particular, was scathing in people's attitudes to the African Cup of Nations, saying that it's a tournament that just is so insulted. And we're going to talk about a particular incident that happened in the competition in a moment. But first of all, Des, let's start with you. You support Liverpool. You've lost two incredibly crucial players. The Africa Cup of Nations happens every 2 years. How do you feel about the Africa Cup of Nations in the global football calendar?
Let me just start off with a different point. And I'm a huge, huge advocate of the regional championships. I think the ASEAN championships that we've just had was fantastic, not for Malaysia, but the Indonesia story, the Thais coming good, the Vietnamese not getting there. So the local tournaments are fantastic for your own country. So the only reason it's actually become a talking point is because so many African players are now playing in the top flight in England. France has been bedeviled by the African Cup of Nations for years, but never their top teams. So it's purely because it's impacting now the top English teams that it's become a talking point. And the teams know this when they sign the players. They did try to move the African Cup of Nations, but it's a known. So you've got to take it on the chin. It's one of the difficulties. If you sign a Naby Keita or you sign a Sadio Mane, you know you're going to lose them for a month, maybe a month and a half, once every 2 years. Scheduling isn't great. So it's just... I'm a big proponent. You just look at the reaction in Africa. You look at the Sierra Leone goalkeeper breaking down at the end of Sierra Leone's 1-0 victory. Absolute tears. It means so much to them. And football has got to mean more than just the top clubs. So I'm all for it. I wish the scheduling could work out, but we have a kind of rainy season in Africa. So December, January, February is the best time. English teams have just got to play, got to learn to live with it. Maybe the new FIFA calendar might help. Maybe two World Cups might come in and help. Maybe that is part of the solution.
Oh, please. No, please.
Yeah, okay. Can I just jump in? I just want to completely agree with Des. And I want to point out that, you know, over the last few days, you've seen the African Cup of Nations getting, because pre-tournament, people like Ian Wright came out in public and said that he deserved more respect and all that kind of stuff. And as soon as the tournament started, there's obviously been a number of controversies. There's obviously been a number of funny incidents here and there. And people are using that as ammunition to prove their point, which is that this is why the AFCON isn't celebrated. But I'm like, when have we become such perfectionists with football? I mean, this is part and parcel of why we celebrate the game, right?
Absolutely.
Like, it can be messy. It can be controversial. And that's why we love it. We don't need it to be absolutely perfect at all times. And
hence, we don't need VAR.
and just to make a point, because they're obviously referencing the Tunisia game a couple of days ago when the referee blew the full-time whistle on the 85th minute and then had to get the players out, and it became a whole controversy. And people were, you know, propping it up as though it only happens in the AFCON. But no, it happened in La Liga a few months ago when a referee blew, I think, the whistle on the 88th minute or the 89th minute, and players went back in the dressing room, had to be called out back. In the Premier League, Bruno Fernandes scored a penalty kick after the final whistle had been blown. I mean, things like this happen, but it's not a regional problem. It's not an AFCON problem. I think the discussion around AFCON has always had a bit of xenophobia attached to it. Over the years, it's always been there. But it's genuinely nice to see the discussion around this tournament become much more progressive over the last few years.
Yeah.
So Bob... Yeah. Bob, I think we might drop the talk about the comical refereeing decisions in the African Cup of Nations after
Keisha's impression. The referee made correct decisions. Unlike Martin Atkinson, the referee's decisions were correct.
No, the calling of time at the end was not
calling
correct.
Calling of time was incorrect.
Yeah, but the red card.
Yeah, but there was a bit more to it than that, wasn't there? I don't think that referee is going to be sponsored by Rolex anytime soon. unless they take the view, you know, was it disaster advertising, and say that it wouldn't have happened had he been wearing a Rolex or something. You know, some companies do that.
Yeah, I think that he didn't take account of the fact that he'd already done a hot weather water liquid break, and he hadn't put that in.
Yeah. Can I just endorse what Keisha's saying there, actually? I would go further. I think it's, as Ian Wright said, tinged with racism, this whole attitude. Graham Poll, the English referee, famously awarded a player 3 yellow cards. Remember that? I think it was in South Africa.
Yep.
No one said, oh, that's typical of English referees. It's a banana republic or anything like that. They only say that when it happens in Africa, in the AFCON. And it's very unfortunate. In fact, it's sod's law, basically, that this has happened. Because just when at the competition was getting taken a bit more seriously because of the high-profile players in it and all that this should happen, a comical, Monty Python-esque almost situation occurs. It was absolutely the last thing that football needed. And it's everything that the racists wanted to hear. And even the Daily Mail was, I thought, rather dog whistle in splashing this story really big. They didn't actually say anything But the prominence they gave it, you know where they were coming from in this. And it is really unfortunate. This referee actually reffed two games in the World Cup in 2018 in Russia, you know. And no one, I don't think anyone found fault with him at all. But yeah, it is, I think it just goes back to racism. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And can I just say just one final thing? Just don't let the controversies, anyone listening out there, don't let the controversies, you know, let you make you forget the 97th minute Sadio Mane winner. Don't let these controversies take away from the fact that Comoros are participating in their first ever AFCON and they did exceptionally well against Gabon. You know, there's so many stories, there's so many epic moments, there's so many exciting kits and goals, and some of the best players in the world are playing in it. It's a tournament that deserves to be celebrated, not looked at with a magnifying glass to pick and you know, choose incidents to blow out of proportion.
Wow. He knows African football too. oh my God. I don't even know who Solomon Rondon plays for. I, full disclosure. He knows everything. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of this week's show. It's been an absolute pleasure on this, well, sad day, but football carries on, and I'm glad that we are back. So I'd like to thank Des Corkill.
Our memories for Sherby, and congratulations for the first 1 hour, 14-minute show.
And thank you to Bob Holmes.
Well, thanks, everyone. And I'm glad you're still with us. We've had a little interlude, but I think you understand why. We're going to carry on. The show must go on, as we keep saying. And it will, in the capable hands of Cam Raslan. I'm sure of that.
Yeah. And finally, Kishanan Sundaresan.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys. Definitely good to be back. I mean, it still feels surreal that we've lost two incredible individuals in the space of, what, less than a month. But yeah, ultimately, we've got to celebrate their lives and we will keep their legacy going.
Thanks, guys. And tune in next week when I challenge Kishnan's knowledge of China second division football. and so, well, thank you. And please join us next week for another edition of What Are We On The Ball here on BFM 89.9.
Absolutely brilliant.
On the Ball on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.